Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
This is Marlon Wayans.
I'm Eli Roth.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Hey everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
Hey, everybody, it's Todd. For the next few weeks, I'm actually in Vancouver shooting, so you're going to hear some ambient background noise. I have a really special guest this week. She's been a writer for a very long time in Hollywood, and in fact, didn't start off writing for Hollywood, started off in the Washington Post writing in politics. And I wanted to have her on this week to talk about how the business has changed, how the big guns of Hollywood like Michael Eisner and John Peters and Peter Guber and even Harvey Weinstein shaped the business, and how in her covering it for all these years, how it's been different in terms of her coverage and in terms of the way she views the business and how it's changing, and how we've gone from having these few lone mavericks that could greenlight movies to these big committees that are now responsible for making decisions of what we're all watching. We have deep dive into everything from how movies get greenlit through the business of movie making through the Me Too movement. Enjoy. All right, I'm here with Kim Masters. Kim, hi.
Hello.
Thank you for doing this.
My pleasure.
I am such a massive fan of your podcast.
Thank you.
A massive fan of you anyway. I've known you for a long time.
You have.
I'm a huge fan of your writing and your books. And this your podcast is just I love it so much, because you really are just talking about stuff that's happening in the moment, and it really keeps me inspired just to stay in this business,
right.
Frankly.
Sometimes, yes.
But,
I mean, we try to keep it really eclectic, you know. Sometimes people who are huge in the business, and sometimes people who have these funny corners of the business. You know, it's fun to find people who have done something where I really like it. Sometimes on Twitter, people say, I saw the subject of the show and I thought, I'm not interested in that. And then I was totally interested in that.
Yeah.
That's when I feel like we've really... That's how
I run my podcast too, is I really just geek out over talking about the business and talking and deep diving into people's careers and kind of what inspired them. So you've done everything. I mean, you've worked at the Washington Post, you've worked at Esquire, you've worked at Premiere, you're the editor at large at
Hollywood Reporter.
I'm going to say Hollywood Pictures. That's going back to my Disney days. And you've written you co-wrote the John Peters and Peter Guber book,
and you
wrote a book about Michael Eisner.
I did.
And you have done huge exposés on everybody from Harvey to Ovitz to Les.
Yes.
And
yes.
So I feel like I really wanted to talk to you about, from a journalist's perspective, of your feeling about the history of the business, like going back to those days when you were writing.
The fun times.
Specifically at Premiere, too, which is so funny because Rupert owned that paper.
He did.
And those were times where Ovitz was king, and you famously were going back and forth with him.
I was.
And then all the way through the Eisner years, and then through the Les years and the Harvey years, and now kind of where we are in sort of the corporatization of our business, and also with Netflix sort of dominating everything.
Well, yeah.
So let's go back to Premiere. Was that your first writing gig in entertainment?
It was my second.
Okay.
I had been in print. I had been like in a trade, publications, writing about legal stuff, which was very good training, by the way, because when you interview lawyers, you better listen to every word. Like, they will slip a word in that basically nullifies the whole rest of the sentence. And so you learn to be all ears when you interview lawyers. So that was good training, but I was fed up with it. I went to the Daily News in the Valley. I wanted to get
here?
To a regular... Yeah, here.
Did you study journalism here?
I've never taken a class in journalism.
No way. So when did you decide that you wanted to be a writer?
Well, I graduated from college. I didn't know what to do. And everybody said, you're a good writer, which to me was not a thing I was really aware of. I just felt like I am. And so I thought, I really honestly, and this is like one of those things where you see that on the internet sometimes, like, name something that people, youth of today wouldn't understand. I looked in the, you know, in the newspaper and classifieds for writing jobs, and I got hired by one of these trade. I was in D.C., which is where I'm from. I got hired by a trade publication, guidance counselors.
Wow.
And I ultimately got interested in journalism. They got this newsletter every day that was very inside policy stuff in Washington, very wonky. And I didn't, I mean, look, if I had gotten a job writing ad copy, I might be doing that. You know, I just didn't, I was sort of interested-ish in journalism, but I didn't understand it at all, to be honest. And so, but I got intrigued. Every day we got this newsletter and it would say, sources say this is going to happen or this is where the policy is headed. And I would think, how do they know? Who are these sources? How do you find them? And it was so intriguing that ultimately I got into a spat with the guidance counselors, and I called this little publication. It was called Education Daily. And I said, do you have any jobs? And they said, well, yes, because the way these publications run is on the sweat of kids who want to be in the you know, journalism. They were expensive. Like, you would right. pay a lot of money to get that inside information, but they would hire these kids. A lot of them went on to very good careers, but you would start there. And they said, sure, we have the Supreme Court.
Wow.
Which I knew nothing. If you'd said to me, name three justices, I'm not proud of this. I couldn't have done it, honestly, at that stage of my life. But I said, okay, because I needed a job. So I ended up standing there in the Supreme Court just, and this again was great training because you had to read, you'd read a brief in a Supreme Court case and you'd go, these are amazing arguments. These people are going to win. And then you'd read the other brief and you'd go, wait, they didn't mention this, this, and this. And you realize you have to look at all the arguments.
It's as much what you leave out as what you put in.
All right, exactly. And that you have to learn how to realize when you're being pitched a very slanted BS thing, which happens all the time in my work here in Hollywood.
Well,
somehow
that is perfect training for Hollywood.
So I was sort of, but you know, in newspapers and journalism, they're not that imaginative about hiring. So I was labeled, you're a trade publication person, you're legal. I got labeled legal reporter. And when I ultimately was trying to make this leap into mainstream regular journalism, I went to the Daily News kind of desperate at that point because I needed a job, and I thought they'd put me at the courthouse in Van Nuys. But they actually did take a leap in imagination, and they said, how about the Hollywood Beat?
Wow.
And they figured that I had gotten inside. I'd written these pieces about law firms and the politics. Actually, I'll tell you something that might amuse you, Todd.
Yes.
I'd written these inside pieces about law firms, and they thought, well, why can't she take that skill and do it to studios?
Yes.
Now, it's very different. It's much easier with law firms. It really is. I mean,
I
it really
imagine.
Is. But I am the person who coined the phrase for the CAA Young Power Hungry Youth.
Young Turks.
Young Turks,
yes.
Which was taken from the legal world because that's what they called the young restless partners in law firms.
Because they used to call them like
they didn't call
zombie.
Them anything.
But didn't they say like the zombie because they all wore the same suits?
Well, they called them the Moonies.
The Moonies.
That's what they called CAA
agents. I like yours so much better.
But what the origin was, the Premier Power List happened. And one of our editors wanted to put the late Jay Maloney on, and he was like 22 years old.
Right.
And I said, we can't put Jay Maloney on this list, but it's a group. It's a group of guys. It was five guys, right? It was like Richard Lovett, Doc O'Connor, Kevin Huvane, you know, these
Brian
people. Brian Lord and Jay Maloney. So I said, let's give them a line and we'll have to call them something. What should we call them? The Young Turks.
Amazing.
But to go back, I was at the Daily News. I had the worst year of my professional life because everybody was like, who are you? Like, they hadn't even had anybody on the beat. But I did what I do. I called Disney. You will appreciate this story.
What year was this?
It was probably like late midsummer, fall of 88.
Okay.
I think. Maybe 89. I'm sort of a little fuzzy on that, but okay. I think 88.
So Jeffrey and Michael had pretty much just got there, right?
No, they'd been there since 84,
okay.
I think.
Okay.
And Michael was quite established.
For
Eisner.
Sure, yes.
I said, and Irwin Oaken was his PR man. I said, I would like to interview Michael Eisner. And he laughed so hard that he had to call me back. He called me later to apologize, which was very nice of him.
That's very
but
nice.
That is the attitude. The people are like, what are you? And I, you know, my strategy was act like you totally deserve to interview Michael Eisner. Why should I? I mean, of course, it was this, you know, paper in the Valley, whatever. It wasn't the LA Times or even at that point, the Herald Examiner, which would not return my call when I wanted to try to get a job there. And the LA Times proposed to let me cover some parties. So that was
very nice
idea. Yeah. And so I flailed on the beat for a long time. Nobody would talk to me. And the big break was when David Putnam got fired and I got the – he was head of Columbia Pictures.
Yeah.
He was a very big controversial player, and he got very abruptly fired, as you will recall.
Yep.
And I somewhat lucked into and somewhat worked my way into an exclusive – I had never met him.
Wow. It was and didn't Dawn Steele take the job after he left?
I think she did, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that when I did that interview with David Putnam, everybody wanted that interview. Every
wow.
newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, all of them wanted to get that interview with this person who had just been very publicly fired. And that was a shot heard round.
That's amazing.
I remember going to a party the night of, and there was a drunk reporter from the Hollywood Reporter actually staggering around saying, "That woman scooped the world. She scooped the world." And it really did. It was a game changer. All of a sudden, Michael Eisner was available.
Right.
Bob Daley and Terry Semel were available for lunch. Barry Diller at Fox was available. All of the people who was like, "Don't even try calling my number," were like, "Come on over," because I think they saw this is going to be a person who's going to be a person who we have to deal with.
Perfect. This is a perfect segue. So at that time, all those people you mentioned, it was Michael, it was Barry Diller, it was Terry and Bob at Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
It was Sherry Lansing and maybe –
I don't think Sherry was there
Stanley
yet.
Stanley Jaffe at that point?
I think it was even pre. Was it like Frank Mancuso?
Wow, it had to be Mancuso. Yeah. These are these pillars. You know, they're all pretty much
big personalities.
Yeah, big personalities. They're all pretty much independent companies. They're not owned by anybody else at that point, really. I think Paramount was owned by Gulf Western,
right.
But like Sony hadn't come in yet. These are
right.
all independent companies.
Oh, it was a different
that
world.
Yeah. So tell me about the world. They lived and died by their balance sheets. And Joe Roth, who was a dear friend and a mentor, and I worked with for a long time, said back in the day when he was at Morgan Creek at the time, these guys lived and died on $100 million. Swing, right? That's pretty much how their
yeah.
bottom lines were.
I mean, there were people in New York,
yeah.
you know, who were the money people.
Right.
And then it's always been that there's been an East Coast perspective and a West Coast perspective. And I think in the East Coast, the movies were sort of like, you know, widgets. And
right.
they were either good widgets or not such good widgets. And in the West Coast, it was much more, there was more drama and it was more fun, honestly.
So in the late 80s, early 90s, what was it like for you as a reporter outside looking in at these big personalities and these guys running these companies?
Oh, I think it was – I mean, it feels like it was more fun, honestly. It really does. I mean, because they were big personalities. And to me, I've always covered Hollywood, even though in that phase of my life, I actually left after being here for several years and went to Washington and covered – some political things at the Post.
For the Post, yeah.
But I always covered Hollywood as politics. I'm supposed to be a business reporter, but the dirty little secret is I don't really read balance sheets very well, and I can't talk about mezzanine financing. I don't know anything about that stuff. I understand politics much better. And it always has amazed me the way Wall Street analysts will say, "Well, this is what we see happening here." And I'm like, "Well, that's because you have no clue about the personality." I mean, look at Michael Eisner for one example.
Yeah.
We'll just fast forward to when Michael fires Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Yep.
He could have settled the lawsuit Jeffrey filed against Disney for this money that he was owed. He could have settled it for $70 million. Rational decision. All these guys sit there and say, and occasionally it gets to be a woman, but not really even at that level. I don't think we've ever had a woman, maybe now with Sherry Redstone, but not before. They say, "Well, I'm doing what's in the best interest of my shareholders and my company and my stock price." No, they're not.
Right.
They're doing what's in the interest of their ego.
Right.
Certainly Michael Eisner fighting with Jeffrey. What did that lead to? Total humiliation with all the stuff that came out in court where he called Jeffrey, "I hate the little midget," all the things that came out in this trial. And he settled for, what was it, close to $300 million.
Right. Well,
that is not rational.
No. Well, the truth is that the person who was rational at that company, because I was there for 10 years, was
Frank Wells.
And Frank, we would sit in these big staff meetings and Frank would sit next to me because I would translate for Frank, you know, because he was not in the minutiae of the daily, what was happening in the movie business. And then Michael would sit at the head of the table and Frank would go, "Who's that? What project is that?
What's mm-hmm.
as everybody was pitching." And he'd go, "What's that?" And then you'd hear Michael say something like, "Why are we paying the director of photography $8,000 a week? We should pay him $1,000 a week because that's what they paid at Paramount."
Right.
And then Frank would go,
all right, Michael, let's table that. You and I will talk about that later. And he would calm Michael
right,
down and be like, don't do that.
But
and so when Frank died, it was
dead,
Michael,
you know?
Michael unplugged.
Well, that was exactly, yeah. That was the beginning of a big domino effect in Hollywood.
So as you start to interview these guys,
yes.
Barry and then Michael Ovitz enters the scene.
Yes.
The thing that strikes me about a lot of your writing, because in researching this, I went back and read a lot of your old amazingly detailed, fun articles. And of course, I was at Columbia as an assistant when Peter and John took over. It was amazing. And then I went to Disney. So
right.
I'm really weirdly, like, personally connected to all
right,
of your writing.
Right, you're following along.
In your writing, it felt like these guys are really trying to kill each other a lot of the time. I mean, that doesn't seem to really happen now, except for maybe everybody wants to kill Netflix.
Yeah.
But back then, it really was like they were really messing with each other and trying to use the press as
absolutely.
Their widget and their fulcrum to get an advantage.
There was definitely, vendettas and wars.
What was your perception of the movie business then? I mean, there was huge producing deals. There was first dollar gross.
Yes.
There was not that many movies being made, and everybody, and there wasn't really a brand. Disney, sort of.
Right.
The brand is really the person running the company, correct?
Right. I mean, the person defined the culture of the company, as to some degree they do now. But, I mean, it was just such a different thing. I had Don Simpson, the producer, was like my professor. And I remember when we were working on Hit and Run, at one point, John Peters invited us over. Me and my partner, Nancy Griffin, and I were invited to John's house. And Don was on the phone with me, and he's like, tell me where he sat, where you sat. Did he serve food? What kind of food? Every single beat of this. And I'm thinking, is it really that complicated? But he was like deconstructing the signals of everything. And he really did teach me an enormous, I mean, as you know, Don was, you know, I miss him. He was an amazing, amazing source. Everybody talked to Don.
Yeah.
And Don was like this Don was very brilliant. He was a hot mess. He was, you know, drugs, commercial sex workers. But, you know, he really, talk about a guy who followed the politics of Hollywood, like, obsessively. He was that. I used to call him Ernestine. Remember this? This is really a dated reference, but the character that Lily Tomlin played on Laugh-In, where she was constantly plugging in the phone calls and listening. And he was like that guy. And I would always be amazed as dramas were unfolding in Hollywood, he would be like, I mean, I can say this now because he's not alive and he doesn't have a family left for somebody to take revenge on. You know, he would say, well, Michael called me and told me this, and then David said that, and Jeffrey said this, and I would be like, why are they, do they not know he's telling me all of this stuff?
And why were they doing it? What do you think drove them? Why were they, you know, talking to you or talking to each other and trying to get, I guess, a political or gossipy advantage on each other? What do you think drove them back then?
It was competition. They were wanting to win. They were wanting to be the king of, they all wanted to be king of Hollywood, right? They all wanted to be, I mean, some of them were more, I mean, Bob Daly is much more dignified and restrained, and he did see the humor. I mean, I remember when we were doing Hit and Run, you know, Bob didn't sit and gossip with reporters. That was not his thing. Don Simpson loved it and enjoyed it, but that's not Bob Daly. Bob Daly picks and chooses when he wants to impart information, but he did sit down and talk to me about John and Peter, and he had Terry Semel.
Because they had a deal at Warner Brothers at the time.
And they did see the humor.
Right.
And I remember them telling stories, and Bob literally had tears of laughing so hard he cried because they were so over the top and ridiculous. John and Peter were as a you know, they were like cartoon characters, which is why Hit and Run was such a successful book.
So great. And back then, I mean, it's you know, the Warner Brothers had a jet, the Warner's jet.
They had
a house in Cabo that they would let their producers go to.
Does not exist.
Don and Jerry had, you know, these huge first dollar
deals.
Producing deals,
deals
that don't exist anymore. You know, John and Peter had these huge deals. And each one of these guys was like, you know, the face of the company. And they had green light. It was like one person had green light back then.
Yeah, it was a
world. One person having green light, I mean, I'm sure when the person got green light, that was the person that, you know, you were trying to connect to, because they would be the decision makers for the company. Do you find that one person having, from a journalist's point of view, one person having green light, do you think the movies were better? Do you think it going with someone's gut and having one person, or obviously we're going to evolve to these huge committees now? But what did you find in terms? I'm assuming you're a big movie fan, so
be so sure.
But when you were talking to these guys and seeing kind of,
I will just seriously say that I think part of the reason I'm good at what I do is I never set out to cover Hollywood.
Right.
I'm not invested in Hollywood. I'm not a movie freak. I'm not a movie star freak. I mean, I am arm's length, and I think that's why. I didn't. That's a huge advantage, I would say.
Yeah, because I mean, you've taken these guys to task when they. And there's a quote, and I'm going to bungle it. I'm sorry. Where somebody said, "Why are you making me look like an asshole?" And you said, "Stop being an asshole." So when you,
I'm sure, I did say that.
when you were covering the town at that time and covering these big personalities specifically, did you start to see the seeds of change of like big companies going to start coming in and buying, and then what would happen to these guys?
I mean, it became clear at a certain point that we transitioned. I mean, we transitioned. It was happening even when Barry was at Paramount, when Barry Diller was and Michael were running Paramount. You started to see this change, you know, then it was Gulf and Western, and then it was, you know, I can't even remember quite the sequence, but it was, you know, Sony, Matsushita. It was
14 people bought Universal in a row.
Yeah, lots of people bought Universal. I mean, it was clear that the winds were blowing that way, and you started to see a change. I mean, if you look at the past, David Geffen didn't go to college. Jeffrey Katzenberg, no college. Michael Eisner, college. but you didn't need to go to college. Now you need to go to college to work in the mailroom at WME. So it was a much more entrepreneurial, you know, more related to the days when these guys who used to sell schmatas came and started studios than now. Now you've got Sony Pictures run by a lawyer, Paramount Pictures, a lawyer, you know, the Warner Brothers, an MBA. It's not the kind of guys. These are suits, right? They're suits. They may wish they were not suits. You know, I think they wish that they were creative types, but they are kind of suits.
And back then, I mean, at the core, they were all for the most part creative guys that had ambition.
I mean, Barry Diller was always a bit of a hybrid. You know, he was always wringing his hands about the money. And Michael was sort of also, I mean, when I wrote that book about Michael, I would think I understood him, and then he'd do something completely contradicting whatever I thought. He would be like, "I'm not doing this," and then he would do the thing that it was very hard to, but you know, I think, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Terms of Endearment where Barry was like, "We can't," or whether one of them was very for it, the other one was very against it. You know, but they would still gamble, you know, they would still gamble in a way that was like crazy sometimes.
Right.
But at the same time, Barry was enough of a businessman that he was a hybrid. I think he was one of the first true hybrids in the business that. And Michael, you know, when he went to Disney and was in contention to go from Paramount to Disney, which was a big leap for him, and he made the play to get that top job. And I remember he was taking accounting classes. He was trying to become more financially astute kind of guy.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I don't know that he really was. I remember Barry said about him, his mind is like a pinball, and I think it remained that way.
Well, so you just said something that's so important, and I want to drill down on a little bit, is these guys would take big gambles. And that's what was, and you say it was fun. That's what was fun about the business back then. And by the way, this even predates me, but guys taking gambles on their gut, they were entrepreneurs, as you said, and they were gamblers. And I think that now the business has tried to like bake the gambling part of it out, and you know,
they tried. I think they're figuring out that it doesn't work.
No, I mean the evolution of the business is, as I see it, was from these kind of maverick guys who had, you know, green light on their shoulders, and like you said, they were competitive and they're gamblers and they always wanted to win and they wanted to be able to go to the grill and talk about who
was
doing
better. Yeah, I mean, it was all about the swagger and the winning. Yeah.
And then these big companies started taking over these companies. And for the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, they've wrung their hands about, well, okay, well, who's the best person to run it? Is it marketing guys have tried? Because the marketing people are saying, like, if you just let us do it, we will fix it because we're not going to let you do anything. And they realize it's much easier to see a movie and decide if it's good than read a script and decide if it's good.
Yeah.
And then they brought in accountants and they brought in systems analysts and all these different people. And they figured, well, okay, okay, let's spread green light to everybody. Let's get international in there, marketing in there, domestic in there, and then we'll all decide. And if we all say yes, it's going to be a hit. That doesn't work.
Nope.
So it's an interesting thing as these companies have tried to run the business like a business. It is, but really, you're right. It's a gamble. Every time it's something from your gut, and you go, well, I'm going to double down on that number, and it hits. What is that?
I mean, you look at the things that work, and they are gambles.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Lord of the Rings. Crazy, right? You're shooting three movies simultaneously with spending a fortune. That just is crazy.
And Bob Shea was a guy who was totally comfortable gambling. And he came from he ran New Line. He was a chairman of New Line. He came from doing these little genre pictures. I had DeLuca on here. And then he would always make these big bets and saw Lord of the Rings as like his big, big bet. And he was right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I could deal with it. I think that the ability to say, let us put this many $100 million on a thing, I wouldn't sleep at night, even if it's not my money.
Right.
But these people have the ability to do that. And more power to them. I mean, sometimes you have somebody who connects, and more often than not, and that person is golden. That's
Kevin
power.
Kevin Feige right now, who runs Marvel.
I think the most valuable executive. He's a hybrid as well,
yeah.
Obviously. But yeah, he's the most, I think, probably the most valuable person.
By far.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we talk about the power list sometimes, and you say, well, but technically he purports to, and I'm like, okay, if he calls Bob Iger up and says, I will quit if I have to report to fill in the blank, he ain't reporting to that person. He has that power. He doesn't choose to exercise it. He absolutely has it. Yes, when you do what he has done, that's, you can't invent or construct that. You know, that is extraordinary. And, you know, you may not like comic book movies, but you can't take away from that achievement.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of producers talk about that don't produce those movies. They're like, oh, you know, comic book movies. But
what happens when Warner Brothers was trying it without having Kevin Feige.
It's a chicken or an egg thing. It's like the reason why they're so popular is they're good. If they weren't good, it's not just that they're comic book movies. Yeah, they have to be good.
You can't think your way through it, really.
Right.
You know, you have to feel it. And I have found, it's really quite an interesting thing. When we're doing Hit and Run, I noticed this thing. And it's true also at Disney in the time when everything was going very well. There are sometimes inadvertent or somewhat invisible partnerships. For example, there was a period at Sony, because when John and Peter took over Sony, we agreed to do Hit and Run before they really had their asses in the chair. And the premise was that they would fail spectacularly. And so for a long time, I was in Washington at that point. Nancy Griffin was here, and they would have a movie, and there would be a lot of hype, and she would say, well, what if they have a huge hit? Because if they had had one true breakout, it kind of would have screwed the book. And I would say, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen, and it didn't. But there was a period where it didn't suck as badly as it did, mostly, thank God for us, because, you know, it still sells in ebooks, that book, and it's quite old now. But I was trying to figure it out when we were working on the book. Why? Why did this little period of movies sort of work? And the answer seemed to be that they were movies that were put into production by Frank Price, who had been running Columbia, mm-hmm. but brought into the marketplace by Mark Canton.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Price was a sort of hyper-cerebral guy who overthought and was way up in his head.
Well, I was at Price Entertainment. That's why I became an assistant at Columbia, because I was at Price Entertainment.
You correct me if I'm wrong about
the
cerebral.
You're right.
And Mark Canton was more like this marketing and, like whatever.
Well, he came from the John and Peter school of
hype.
Of making movies. Which
so when
was...
you took Frank's overly thought-out cerebral whatever and gave it a little Mark zhuzh, on the market, suddenly the movies didn't completely fail.
Right.
And the same thing is really true, I think, when you look at the partnerships that Michael was in, everybody thought Michael was such a genius. But then again, when you took away Jeffrey and Frank Wells, everything started to go south right away. I mean, that happened in the space of a very compressed period of time. As you know, Frank Wells died, I think it was April of 84, of 94, I guess it was. Jeffrey was fired a short time thereafter. Yeah. And from that point forward, if you did a chart, the slope goes downhill. Like, everything goes wrong consistently. And it's Michael, as you said, unbound, and because the partnership's gone. Right. And so it's those partnerships where it may not be so obvious to the people on the outside,
yeah.
but if you're really a student of what's going on, you realize it's not just, you know, this is something that came up when I was writing about John Lasseter. You know, there were a lot of very resentful animators who said John Lasseter was certainly a huge talent, but there are a lot of people at Pixar and Disney Animation, and this guy sucked up so much limelight. Now we'll see, you know,
right.
he's over there at Skydance. We'll see how that goes.
Right.
His people that he developed, brilliant people. Like, I mean, he didn't really develop Brad Bird, but Pete Docter, yeah. people, we'll see how they do.
60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? Get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a True Cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions and you'll get an accurate True Cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions and get the answers you need so there's no surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade-in for your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today.
Celebrity Big Brother is back, and we've got recaps of every single episode here on Rob as a Podcast. So whether you watch for the epic blindsides or for the insanity like Ricky Williams giving a colon massage to a constipated Kato Kaelin, yes, that happened. Check out our Celebrity Big Brother coverage on Rob as a Podcast on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, or the Podcast One app.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
This is The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Pixar has just had such an incredible run. And I think the other thing you said is just so important, which is you have to feel your way through this. You can't really think. I mean, you can to some degree, but when your back is against it, which is generally why there are these ebbs and flows in these studio jobs too. Like, you can see it's almost like clockwork. When a studio president or chairman gets fired, pretty much guaranteed that the next 2 years of those movies are going to be huge hits.
That's exactly true.
And so, because what happens is you're kind of going with it. Things are starting to go sideways. You're starting to try to think your way through. And then, and you know, it's interesting. Donna Langley had like the one time.
The big year.
What's interesting about her is they stuck with her. And then, you know, obviously they were having some issues for a few years. And Ron Meyer stuck with her. And then you get to a place where your back's against the wall. You're like, nothing I'm thinking is working. And you just go by feel. And that's when Donna, everything took off for her and that company. And they had that gigantic year, and they've continued ever since. It's this tightness that these corporations kind of make these executives live
right.
under.
All a quarterly reporting of pennies is not healthy.
The quarterly reporting is the thing that's – it's death. Because if you have executives that are just trying to stem the tide for that particular quarter, they're not thinking long term. They're not – because these movies that they're green lighting now aren't coming out for 2 years because you have to make them and make them good and preview them. If you're trying to just exist in the present – and satisfy that quarter, you're dead.
Well, this is what we're going to see. Like with AT&T, are they going to figure out how the business works, or are they just going to wreck everything? I mean, I think it's a good question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's good. That's a good segue to talk about this stuff. So it's funny because I've had a lot of people tell me, oh, you know, the home video market disappeared and it's gone down. It didn't. They sold it to Netflix.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of changed.
Well, they got hoisted on their own petard. They sold all their movies to Netflix, took for the quarter.
Right.
And you go, oh, $100 million
well,
are friends.
Well, I don't think they had any way. I mean, maybe there was a way, but they surely did not foresee what the monster they were building.
Well, yeah. And then because what happened was in the DVD market collapsed, everybody just went to Netflix because that's what they just thought. That's where
where our cash comes from.
Forever, it was called the Blockbuster. It was the Blockbuster killer. So right. You just looked at it as the digital.
They were like, Yahoo,
store.
I'm selling this old TV show.
Exactly.
Woo-hoo.
Or every movie. And even Bob Iger did it, too. He would, you know, they would make whatever they made on every movie, and it was great for them. And then Ted was smart enough to figure out, this is never going to last. They're going to get wise very quickly to
you
this
better start
to this
making
business.
Some originals.
We have to make originals. And I think what's interesting about Netflix is their back isn't against the wall. It in a weird way, just and by their own culture, their back's against the wall because they're like, crap. There was a moment where there was like 65. I don't know this specific math, but I'm going to guess there was 65 movies coming down a year probably because people were like, wait a minute, we. Netflix is making all the money here. And so Ted went, well, we have to make 80 because we have to fill that pipeline. Otherwise, we're going to run out of stuff. Eventually, everything's going to be taken down. And I think that all of these companies, AT&T and all these companies seeing that now, I think they're just going to try to figure out how to make a more linear pipe. So you start off with some theatrical. I listened to on a podcast, I just heard Bob Bakshi talking about all the different ways that their content is consumed on all these different platforms. So I don't know. I think it's a good thing for the business.
I mean, Netflix has really established itself as what a lot of people feel is indispensable, but they're having trouble with lower income households, right?
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting because I have been watching that spend, and I do have a – it reminds me of – I mean, I'm not suggesting that Netflix is going bankrupt because I'm not. But, you know, I remember back when we were doing Hit and Run, quarter after quarter, Sony would say, everything is fine. Everything is fine. And as I said before, I'm not that great at reading the balance sheets and figuring these spreadsheets at all. But I would think, how can everything be fine?
Right.
Like, where's the movie where the revenue came from that everything is fine? And then one day they were like, actually, we're writing down $3 billion. And I'm like, thank you, just before we published. Thank you. Thank you. But with Netflix, you feel like that spend feels so crazy to me. I don't understand how you sustain. So, you know, just very recently, Netflix is like, we're raising pretty stiff little boost there. I feel like they are racing the train in a way. Like
right.
They are racing the train. Like, we are at Netflix. We are the ones you love. We've got all this stuff. We've got something for everybody, damn it. And the studios are like, oh, yeah, well, these are our libraries. Take a look at those.
Right.
And remember, like, you saw how everybody had a breakdown when they thought Warner's was taking Friends back. Well, there's no world where Warner's doesn't take Friends back. I mean, they'd have to be insane.
Yeah.
Short term, they'll still milk the cash out of Netflix. But longer term, and I don't mean longer term 10 years from now,
they
will take Friends back. So Netflix is racing. Like, I need to be indispensable without Friends, without Gossip Girl, I don't know who wins, and I mean, does the Comcast idea, we're going to do this with ads and you'll pay less and you'll be okay with our ads, you know, with the ads that we're going to make you watch, or which model prevails? You know,
right.
I do think, you know, obviously Disney is daunting.
Yeah.
Daunting.
But even Disney, if you think about it, I think Bob very quickly realized, you know, if we just put our movies on our site, I'm sure somebody much smarter than me came to him and said, you know what? Probably the world could probably consume that in a weekend. Like, you don't have that many titles
right.
that are, you know.
We have a lot of titles, but on the other hand,
there's not that
it's
many.
Finite.
Like, go look on Netflix. Is like thing. So I think that even he was like, which is probably what spurred the purchase of Fox. Yeah, because to deepen the bench and give us a little bit of run room before we have to start making our own originals on our streaming site. And I think that AT&T has that too, which is, you know, the thing about Netflix is, and Friends is a perfect example, is all they really care about is what's going to drive the people to you know, sign up for a subscription. And so, you know, I don't know that Friends is like something where somebody went, you know what, I think I'm going to go to Netflix because I really want to see a Friends rerun. It's something
I think people actually do.
Well,
I honestly have a kid. I mean, they were watching. That's what they're doing.
But it's great that it's there. But what you realize is their real scores are like Bird Box and
I think Bird Box is a score, but I would not. The great proportion of things that people watch on that stuff is old TV shows.
I agree. I'm not saying that that's not what they enjoy when they get there, but these big PR.
In terms of the future, yes.
These Bird, big
saying
things where people
we,
go,
Bird, we and yep. we alone
yes.
have Bird Box is big thing.
Yeah,
yes.
and you get people going, oh, I'll sign up for that.
Yeah.
And then you're right. Once you're there, then you have to keep them there. You've got to have the deep bench of stuff that is, you know.
You just have to keep them the way HBO used to keep. I mean, I used to say, well, I want The Sopranos, therefore. I mean, literally, if I watch nothing else, I have to have this. That's
right.
The same game.
And so I think what you're saying about AT&T is they have a pretty deep bench of good content. They're going to have those things that are going to drive people to that site.
Yes.
So, you know, the Bird Boxes, the, you know, Stranger Things, those things that Warner Brothers is going to have to continue to do to get them to go. And
I mean,
if they can figure that out,
they'll
be fine.
Netflix has had a pretty hot hand in my, like, there's a lot of stuff you and I've never heard of that just goes and lies there in somewhere on Netflix, but they have enough in the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, it's impressive.
Well, especially right now. I mean, everything right now, is working for them, you know, on just all the different cylinders. They have great television with their original series. They have Roma. They have this movie that came from nowhere. I mean, Stuber brought it over. He was a producer on that. And I think probably with A Quiet Place coming out, probably a studio wouldn't have made that movie. And so because it feels similar. It's like, oh, it's your
well, and you look at You, which they pick up from Lifetime, and then now all of a sudden it's a huge deal. I mean, they do throw a ton of spaghetti at the wall, but even you can throw a lot of spaghetti at the wall and have not anything stick. So
well, they have, and they've made a lot of really smart hires with, you know, Stuber and
they
Kendo.
Seem to be doing. Yeah. I mean, look, you could even we had this conversation with the owners of our company, the parent, the CEOs of our parent company. All run the company that had to was behind House of Cards, mm-hmm. and of course they think these are my boss's bosses. But you know, whatever, I'm still me. They're like, we are so smart because we hired David Fincher and we hired Kevin Spacey, which now wouldn't be good, but then was very good.
Yeah.
And you know, that was a brilliant thing to do. And I feel like, yeah, but you know what? There was still no guarantee. That was
still no.
It sounds now that we know it was House of Cards.
Yeah.
Yes, but the odds were not necessarily in your favor.
No. You
can hire David Fincher, and he would burn your money for you. So it's a gamble. Going back to the theme, it's gambling.
It is a gamble, and that's what's so great about Netflix is because they're spending so much money, and they're they have to make content to keep people coming. Otherwise, that it'll just be a blockbuster where you've seen everything, and with no new releases, you'd be in trouble. I think that is a really exciting thing for the business, which is...
Well, if you're a content maker,
yeah.
Woohoo.
Well, and the other thing that Netflix has done for content makers is it's done the legwork to say, hey, you're not playing for the upside. You're playing for, I'm just talking about pure business. You're playing for your fee, and we're going to give you some VIG.
Yes.
The fact that it's not
going
to happen.
That is the counter-argument that is being made now by competitors, which is they're taking you for their... the argument is very simple. You will be safe with us because if your show sucks, you'll still get this much. And most shows kind of fail, whether they suck or not. Let's say if your show doesn't work, you'll get this much. But if your show turned out to be the Big Bang Theory type of hit, you ain't getting that money.
You would never know.
And therefore, this are the argument that companies like, competitors are saying is like, look, they're playing you.
Right.
Don't go there.
Well, but because if you've ever sat in their lobby, you see that every single person in Hollywood, top to bottom, are sitting in that lobby because they want to make their content because the doors have been slammed in their faces pretty much everywhere else. That was kind of how it started, right? Where you would get to Netflix. This was years ago. And so now everybody's there. Everybody's like, they're making great content. They're willing to make it at a reasonable price where you can actually make a living. And yes, American Sniper is like the perfect example of a movie probably that would be made on Netflix now. And you would not know that movie would gross over $700 million worldwide. So you would have lost out on all that upside.
But, safety or gamble?
Yeah, but they've done all the legwork. So now these streamers all have the same argument to make, right? So AT&T can say, hey, maybe the movie will go out theatrical, so maybe you'll have an upside. Well, we'll create a back end for that. But if it doesn't, we have a contingency plan.
Right.
This is what you'll get.
Right.
And so they do have a little bit of a sell. And that's you can feel Netflix is starting to dabble in that. Like, we'll do a limited for awards.
Well, Cuaron just bent them to his will,
And
they
so,
said, if you want to be in the game, and by the way, he's delivered. That movie is going to get nominated, could win. He is delivered. He's like, you want to be in the Oscar game? Do what I say.
Right.
And he was making big demands that other studios, that normally play in that space wouldn't concede.
And so that's another good example of kind of how the business has changed. So now that you're from the outside, from the journalism perspective looking in, what is it like now? Like, what are you finding out? Because it feels like every time I hear your podcast or anybody talk about the business, it's like, I don't fucking know. It's like, it's changing so fast. I have no idea.
Well,
and it's a lot of fear and a lot of insecurity and a lot of, we don't know what the hell's going on.
I mean, on the one hand, we don't know what the hell nobody knows what's going on. I mean, if the herd will thin, and we're seeing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've talked about this on my show many times. Like, wasn't seeing Fox as one of the the herd that was going to get thin. I mean, you know, we were all looking at Sony or Paramount and thinking very vulnerable little sheep out there. And then Sony gets, and then Fox gets taken by Disney. And you're like, whoa, that was scary.
But is it scary? Because this is the other thing. Is the herd thinning? Because Netflix is there now.
Well, and Apple is making noise right now.
And Hulu's there.
Amazon is stepping up.
So is it thinning or is it just that?
No, it's shifting.
We're all freaked out because we're all in traditional media going, ah, and everybody else is like,
if you were in traditional media, you're going, yeah. Because, and if you're at Fox, of course, you're very scared you're going to lose your job, and you may, probably will, right? Which is hard. But there are other, yes, it is shifting before our eyes. So, but I have this idea that, you know, as we just mentioned, as they get more, like the digital outsiders came in and they had a sort of a snotty attitude like, huh, we are the reinventors and the disruptors and we're going to do it our way because our way is better and you're just hidebound and, you know, honestly stupid. But as they come in here, they find out, well, maybe some of these rules exist for a reason, right? And they are inching toward, as we see, like they want to be in the awards game. Corona is going to tell you how that's going to work. It's a little bit like watching Nancy Pelosi school Donald Trump in the new realpolitik of the House majority.
Right.
Like you want to be and play in my field here. Well, I'm an auteur. Now there are not many people who can do that. But if you want to be in the business with a Cuaron, a Jim Cameron, you know, people that tiny little layer of true genius filmmakers, you're going to have to do it their way. And even when you, the talent is in short supply. So let's get away from even that tiny, tiny genius group. You know, you can't treat talent the way Netflix had been treating certain talent. Like I wrote a piece about it and Netflix hated it quite a while ago. Certain people were just being treated not well.
Well, they didn't understand they were a studio, and they fought against it. They called themselves a service, and the people that were there had not really done. They were like acquisitions people. They had not really made movies with.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and so by the way, I love when this happens. And as I've been, I'm such a geek about the history of the movie business. You just go right back to our first conversation about David Putnam. He did the exact same thing. He was an outsider, came in, and goes, "You idiots." I got this.
Right.
I'm going to show you.
Anybody
guys
who tries to reinvent Hollywood ultimately kind of gets hurt. Yes.
Peter Schneider did the same thing. Rich Ross did the same thing. These guys came in and like, please.
They know everything.
Right? I trust me. And then, you know, 18 months later, they're all fired. And same thing with Putnam. And so I do think that's a very smart you know, analysis of it, of these them coming in going, okay, look, it's all about analytics. We know how to do it. We, you know, we created Instagram. We know what we're doing. And then you go, oh, no, Alfonso Cuarón is really smart. None of that makes sense. That movie makes zero sense for if you're trying to think through it.
Right.
Like, wait a minute, it's a really personal story about this woman that raised you in Mexico
language,
City.
And period
another
piece,
language,
no black, actors, and white. Black and white. What are we doing?
There's none of it. But the want to be in business with and show that Reed and Ted and Stuber have done to say, hey, come here. We want you to come here, and this is what we'll do, and this is how we're going to support
you. And you know that if you don't deliver what you told him you would deliver, he will denounce you.
Yeah.
You know?
So you have to.
He's not scared.
Yeah.
So he'll be political, but at a certain point, he'll be like very happy to go on my show, or hopefully, I hope, and say, you know, Netflix wasn't such a good thing. Right. I mean, we just saw, you know, the guys who made Crazy Rich Asians turn down a staggering offer from Netflix.
Yeah.
Why? Because they wanted their movies in theaters.
Yeah.
The movie, you know, in theaters. So, yeah. So there is a push-pull.
I've had both John and Nina on talking about that, and John Chu, and John M. Chu, and Nina Jacobson, and it was not a thinking thing. It was an emotional.
It was
thing
a feeling
of
thing.
Wanting,
but guess what? It's Hollywood.
Yeah, of wanting exactly, and that is exactly what I'm talking about.
And they didn't go. They didn't. I mean, they. I don't know if they matched what they would have made. I don't know what their deal is. But you know what? They're not broke. They're fine.
No,
they're not hungry.
No, and by the way, it's an emotional thing. It's a heart thing rather than a head thing, where John and the author specifically were like, the most important thing is I see myself represented on that
absolutely
big movie screen.
And it was a big deal.
And it was nothing against Netflix. It was, I want to see it. And well, they did.
And Netflix, I believe, and I wrote this piece, like with in the early going with Cuarón's movie, they're sort of acting, I think the phrase I used, which a lot of people were like, ew, thanks for that, was like they're acting like they're passing a kidney stone. Put the movie in theaters. What's the problem? Why are you making such a big deal out of it? People who are really film lovers and want to see Cuarón's movie in 70 millimeter will go and see it. And the rest of them will sit in their living room and watch it. You know, it's I don't know. It's a sales, it's a marketing thing. Just develop the structure for doing that for auteur filmmakers. You're not hurting yourselves, really. Movies are not going to kill Netflix. And if Netflix learns to accommodate, then it won't kill movies. Stop it.
But wait, the flip of it is the theater owners, right? So the flip of it is you can't negotiate with somebody who, if you ask them honestly, how would you like movies to be consumed, right? And you really ask them honestly, and they weren't going to be on the record. Theater owners would say only in theaters.
Of course, they would
ever, never, I never on television, the... never anywhere else. Right. Only in theaters, because then we could screen them
That's
like we used
business.
To for yes. 500 days. And if you really just flip a Netflix, why? I don't want you to be able to go see it anywhere else. First of all, I only get half the revenue, right? It could bomb, right? So if you put a movie out on a theater. Yes, Alfonso Cuarón's movie could be limited and it's going to do fine. But think about it. The first time they go, okay, we're going to put a movie out in 3,000 screens because we got the goods.
No, I don't think they should ever do that.
And it eats it. Then the press is like, this movie sucks and it's dead on the
team. I don't see that as a thing that they would do. I think they do it when they want to do a movie like Mike Roma, when they want to be in the awards game.
Yeah.
And then you do it, you platform it, and you send it out there. I don't think they would do it for a wide release.
I think if they had Gravity. Like if they had made Gravity, they'd be like, this is cool. See it on IMAX. Like
right.
This is an experiential thing.
Movie.
Yeah, see it on IMAX.
Maybe.
So, but I do think it is a fun, not fun, maybe that's the wrong word, but it's a very fascinating answer to the theater owner's insanity that they have not wanted to play ball with anybody for day and date or any sort of conversations other than this is how it's going to go.
Well, movies are still breaking records, right? So people want to go out, and that is not going to change.
Yeah.
So I feel like to some degree, this is a bit of a manufactured. I mean, yes, I understand that theater owners are threatened, but there are movies that should be in theaters. There's money to be made there. I don't think people will stop doing that.
I agree with you.
You know, I don't think Kevin Feige is going to say, gee, Bob, I think it would be great if all of our Marvel movies were streamed on your new platform.
Right.
I just don't see that world happening.
No.
I think, but, you know, what the bigger over thing is going to be, as they're going to march toward each other, Netflix will march a little bit closer to the studio model.
Yeah.
The studios will march toward the Netflix model. And then we're someday, you and I probably will both be dead. There will be some sort of rational order of things again.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, you know, we're condemned. We're living in interesting times.
It is.
Exactly. Live in interesting times.
And since nobody really knows the answer, there's just so many theories about what's going to happen. And also from your perspective, just looking at the state of the business, it's a good segue to, you know, we had just had this record year and on the back of these gigantic, gigantic, gigantic tentpoles. From your perspective, where do you see that headed? Like, do you think that like in the early days of the musicals and the big extravaganzas when Cleopatra and those big musicals were made in the studio system, that then everything else is ceded to streaming? So like, you know.
Doesn't feel like it, though, does it?
Well, because like look at Crazy Rich Asians and Quiet Place, there are movies that can definitely
there
still.
There are movies that still get through and even independent films that make a lot of money. So I feel like. As long as there's a shot, somebody's going to take it, right? We've seen
We're
that
gamblers.
For years.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be harder to fund independent film, and I'm sure that's very real, and I hear about it on my show all the time. But we still see The Rider,
yep.
You know, we still, which is an amazing film.
Yeah.
And we still see Cold War. We still see these movies that, against all odds, seem like they shouldn't. You know, I just had this Korean filmmaker who has Burning in the foreign language race. And, you know, a giant Japanese corporation went to him and said, like, why don't you make this? And when you watch that movie, you'd be like, really? But that happened. Like, so I feel like, you know, I remember at the very beginning of my career when I was covering, Michael Cimino had completely wiped out with Heaven's Gate. And I was sort of fascinated, like, who hires this guy? He had been there was a whole book, Final Cut, about how financially reckless he had been. You know, you could say he's an artist and an auteur, but when somebody's burning your money, it's not that funny. So I thought, who does this? And the truth is, there were people still betting that he's got one more hit in the bat, right? And,
right.
and that happens. That goes on and on. You and I both know
yeah.
people who keep working, and you're like, really? Somebody's hiring this guy? Really? But when they failed how many times
right.
because there's another there's still some gambler who comes along even if it's not that much money and says well I'll put my marker down yeah let's see if that guy can do it this maybe it'll be a woman
right.
I hope I mean, we don't have that many women have had even
no.
had a chance to fail so.
No it's brutal. Do you have another book in you? What are you is there anything
you know
you're
the economics
at?
Of a book don't work out anymore.
Oh wow.
Honestly, I make more money at my job. You know, they come to you with a book idea, and, which happens, of course. You know, I was sort of – I was flooded at one point or another, most recently with the Harvey stuff. Like, oh, you've got to do the Harvey book. And I feel like, first of all, do I want to spend 2 years of my life immersed in Harvey? No, no. But second of all, they were like, okay, well, they, you know, they're like, how about you do a book? And you say, well, I don't know, maybe. And they say, okay, well, why don't you write me a 50-page book Ugh. Proposal for which you'll be paid nothing?
Right.
And you're like, no, because I'm not going to. And they and then, they, I mean, I honestly did, I didn't set out to do a book in the first place. My whole career is an accident, if, you can, if you're getting the picture by now. we did Hit and Run and The Keys to the Kingdom with the scantest, I think maybe I wrote a few paragraphs of, it'll be about this.
And why those two? Why did you choose
Hit and
those
Run,
two?
We were assigned, Dancy and I, to do a piece for Premiere. I actually didn't want to do it. I was yelling and screaming because I always had to do the hard, difficult stories, and I never got to go on set with very rarely have fun, you know. I was like, and they said, no, you have to do it. You have to make it happen. And next thing we knew, we were just surrounded by people bidding for that book, six publishers.
Wow.
Not all of whom had the actual nerve to bid on the book because
right.
several of them had conflicts. But there was a competitive bidding process
wow.
for that book. And we were laughing. We were just like, what is this? And then, this, you know, Brian Burrow, who wrote Barbarians at the Gate, and I did stuff for Vanity Fair. And we were going to do a book, which we should have done, but we couldn't reach an agreement about the terms. He had had a deal in place, and we just couldn't work it out. It was a shame because Brian and I were very good together. We just had super complementary skills. And we did great, if I say so myself, and I'll give all credit to him, but we did great stuff for Vanity. We did a piece about Ovid's, which I'm sure you remember.
Oh,
Ovid's
yeah,
at
sure.
Disney. That
yeah.
thing was the shot heard around Hollywood.
I mean, when Ovid's was there. It was amazing.
There was a shareholder suit. That piece was at the center of this trial. I walk into that courthouse in Georgetown, Delaware in dead winter. At one point, Michael Eisner's on the witness stand. They kept asking about the article. It was so surreal.
Oh,
and
amazing.
Michael, they go, and Miss Masters in her Vanity Fair story, and Michael goes, well, she's sitting right over there, why don't you ask her? And the lawyer goes, Miss Masters is not a party to this litigation. And I wanted to go, yes, but I do have some thoughts that I would like to
can I
share.
Interject? You guys are missing a couple of key points here.
Exactly. Every head in the courtroom is swiveling. It was so absolutely strange. But Brian and I ultimately didn't. It wasn't really meant to be so much a book about Michael. It was a book about what happened after Frank Wells died,
right.
but Michael kind of ate the book because Michael was such a...
Yeah.
And then I realized in the middle that Michael was... You know, nobody had the sex and drugs and rock and roll that John Peters brought to Hit and Run, and I was like, it's not
yeah.
going to be as fun. But the truth now is they want to pay you in six like installments, so
right.
you get this little tiny check, and it's being taxed, and your agent is taking... You know, the whole thing is like, why would I do
right.
that? That's crazy for
right.
me to do that. So they've made it... you know, in those days, me and Tom King, this was a late Wall Street Journal reporter, I remember doing a panel with him at the LA Times Book Festival. We were like, Tom King was like, we got the last two truly great Hollywood book deals. And that was true.
Yeah.
And it wasn't irrational. I don't
His
think
for
books,
Geffen and yours for the
yeah,
Hit and Run.
Michael Eisner.
Yeah.
And I don't think those books sold as well as something like Hit and Run was a bestseller and did really well. I don't even know if it broke even, though, to be honest.
Right.
I don't look at – I'm very oblivious with
right.
numbers like that. But, I mean, it seems to do okay in ebook, but – I we got the last really you know worthwhile, and nowadays it's just not worth my time.
Do you
Long
mi-
answer.
Do you, no, it's great. Do you miss the sex, drugs, and rock and roll of the guys you were writing about before?
Well, first of all, the sex ain't gone.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's true. It's just awful.
I mean, I'm working on a story now that actually has very much brought Hit and Run to mind. I haven't seen a thing like this. I hope I get to break the story, but I haven't seen anything like this since the days of Heidi Fleiss,
wow.
and actually makes Heidi Fleiss look like a very reasonable businesswoman.
Oh, wow.
and I do somewhat miss the freewheeling days where, you know, I mean, I really, where you would hear these stories and you just, your mind would boggle, you know, you'd be like, what? And it was just, you know, it was so, these personalities were so fun. You know, there was a point where David Geffen was at war with Michael Ovitz and Michael was at war with Jeffrey. And these were fun, fun times. You know, David, when Brian and I were working on this Ovitz story, it's like, come to my house in Malibu. And we go to the house and he tells us these yarns. And we're just, we can't take notes any faster. Like, right. We're just like, our eyes are popping out of our heads. And you know, that house was so beautiful. And we're leaving and David is like, is there anything else I can do for you? And I was like, can I just live here? Would that be okay with
in
you?
The guest house down there.
Right. It's just beautiful house.
He sold that house now.
Yes, he did. Yeah. Sad. I mean, somebody got it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I mean, it was this drama when Jeffrey got fired. You know, I was actually in Washington and I flew here and I had this incredible dinner with Jeffrey that went on for like 4 hours, catered dinner for two. I wish I'd written down the courses because they were off the hook. I know there was lobster, but
at one point there was lobster.
There was definitely lobster. I wish I had, really, truly wish I had, because that was a meal. And then there was a dinner in Glendale with Michael that went on for, and Michael had that heart attack not that long before.
And this is going back to your exact lawyer thing of you're hearing each of their briefs.
Exactly. I heard the briefs and they both were like, and this was for Vanity Fair. And it was, you know, I remember being in my hotel and the phone is ringing and they're both going insane.
Oh, no.
And what did that psycho say about me? And I'm like, there was a time where I was at the Daily News in the Valley and I thought if one of these guys would even speak to me, my career would be great. I'd be so happy. And now I'm like, I'm not picking up that phone. I can't cope with another. I can't talk to them anymore. They're making
me more spin.
I can't listen to them. They were so, you know, there are times when you have some stories and people truly feel that their backs are like their careers are on the line. And it's not just Michael and Jeffrey. I mean, it's happened in other contexts. They get so unhinged. It's you're like a therapist. It's like a handful, you know. You're calling you evenings and weekends.
Does that happen anymore? Do you find that there are those kind of personalities doing that to each other?
Oh,
okay.
Bit.
Oh, okay.
But not the, maybe not the same. I mean, it's hard to say because maybe my memory kind of focuses on the high points and drops out the boring parts. But it happens sometimes. I mean, there are definitely times where you feel like, yeah, but the other thing I was going to mention, which I think is so important, this past year for me, I've been doing so many Me Too Time's Up stories.
Oh, I know.
I feel like I've been on a leave of absence, you
right.
know? I mean, I was, this shakeup happened at Comcast and NBC Universal, and I was talking to an executive over there, and I was kind of like, I need you to just kind of catch me up. What's been going on exactly?
What's happening in the movie business now?
I've just been a little busy.
Anything happened?
Because I really have been buried in these stories. You know, there was Roy Price and there was John Lasseter, one after another. Those are hard stories. Yeah. I'm doing one now that involves a really very bad, bad violent assaults. You know,
sorry.
I'm hoping we'll get that one published.
Oh,
you know, we carry around a lot of stuff when we're doing these stories.
Sure.
But it's been it feels very important. And so the business part of it, I felt very frustrated this past week or so because we saw this report that Les Moonves was sitting at the Polo Lounge, although he was harassed by Kathy Griffin, yelling about not wanting to sit near a rapist, which I don't know that he was accused of rape, but whatever. Kathy Griffin is Kathy Griffin and she doesn't hold back. And you know, John Lasseter just got hired at Skydance, although there was a lot of blowback. And you started to feel like, have we been spinning our wheels for the last year or are we making a change in this culture? And I don't know the answer to that yet, but I worry. You know,
right.
I was heartened by the blowback. And it's notable that David Ellison, who's got billions from his father and it's not a public company, is the one who, you know, John Lasseter tried to get hired everywhere. But you just sort of say, aside from the changes of the business, is there a change in the culture? I'm not sure. I mean, I just really hope that some of this is getting some traction.
Right. Well, let me try to change this subject real quick.
That's depressing.
That's okay. I ask this of everybody, and I want to be respectful of your time. Best moment on the job.
Like ever?
Just. What comes to your mind where you go like, that was really cool?
There are just moments. I mean, I can't even pick one. There are moments. Like, I wish I could be more specific, I guess. And maybe I could be if I had more time to think about it. But, you know, when you try to get a story and they don't want you to know the story, those are the stories I do.
Yeah,
those are the ones that
are
mine.
Of course.
And I always feel it's like you're trying to almost deliver a baby and the baby won't come out. Like, come on, get it, be born. I need, and you can't get it to publishing. And there are many, many, many like this. And then suddenly you get that source, that call. And the thing, that baby just comes flying like into your arms.
Oh,
and that is such a moment of, I've got this.
Good.
And it's so satisfying. And then there are moments, you know, where you get tremendous pushback, many, many, many legal threats that I've been through, especially in this past year. You know, there was an encounter, I'll just tell you briefly, we published an allegation against Russell Simmons, who's had many accusers, rape allegation, and he fought back, and they threatened us with a lawsuit. He hired Patty Glaser, and they wanted to put this woman on the record who had worked for him, and she was going to say that, you know, he's a wonderful person, and he could never have. And it turned out that this woman's son had a sexual assault allegation against him. And I said, well, you know, if you want to put her on the record, that's fine. But we will have to say that she had to leave her job because her son had the sexual, which it was a place where she worked. And they said, well, no, you can't. I always loved that moment. You can't do that. And I'm like, actually, I can. At that point, the woman would not at that point come forward because the whole thing was bullshit, honestly.
Right.
And Patty Glaser sent me an email saying, well played.
Wow. Well, you're doing amazing, amazing work, Kim. Thank you. And so your podcast, The Business, is so, so great.
Thank you. Listen to it.
Thank you so much for
people
doing
out there.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.
Hello, guys. It's MMA fighter Chael Sonnen. Check out my podcast, You're Welcome, with Chael Sonnen every Wednesday and Friday right here at Podcast One. We cover the latest in mixed martial arts and everything else going on in the world of sport. Listen free to You're Welcome with Chael Sonnen, exclusively available at PodcastOne.com and on the Podcast One app. If you love the show, share it with a friend and leave us a rating and review.